On Mars with Matt and Hillary, and I'm Matt.
Oh, I'm Hillary.
And it's our Kim Stanley Robinson read-along podcast where we're reading through Aurora.
We are reading through Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson.
And I recently heard from Kim Stanley Robinson, Hillary, via email.
Oh, I did too. I think he probably writes to both of us at the same time every time he writes.
I hope so, yeah. And you're probably better at sending him correspondence than I am. But I finally went ahead and sent him a very long email giving him an update about my life in Maine. And he responded to that with very warm and encouraging words. He's a very lovely man. And he's our number one fan, actually.
He's our number one fan. That's very nice. And he is an extremely nice human being and a great correspondent, actually.
Yes. You know, he gives you the illusion that he really cares about what's going on in your life.
I feel like maybe you would kind of think this from reading his books, but I feel like something, he has a quality of being a person who likes and is interested in other people.
I know. You know? Weird.
It's weird that's not just a quality that is common to people.
I can't identify with that at all, but
no, it's not your thing.
No, not my thing. He's also a really wonderful science fiction author, and he's written this book, Aurora.
This book is great, you know, and I have been thinking a lot about like why. You know, there's like a segment of people who like Stan's early books, or maybe not all of the early books, but they like the Mars trilogy and they like Antarctica and they like the stuff that feels like it fits within some kind of model of like, you know, hard science fiction. Mm-hmm. And then like they don't necessarily like some of the later books like Aurora. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't like Aurora, which I mean, I think that has specifically to do with some stuff that we'll talk about today. Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't think they like 2312 or some of the other more recent ones. And I just think that that's so crazy because like one of the best things about this like amazing science fiction writer is that he has just like been writing these magnificent books for a long time. And, you know, it would be, I don't know, I would think under normal circumstances, you would think what author could possibly sort of top or even continue after the Mars trilogy?
Right.
And yet, like, this is a writer who has continued to be not just writing amazing SF novels, but being really, really inventive with what he's doing, how he's writing, the ways that he's thinking, and both deeply in conversation over the course of his whole writing career up to this point. You know, there are thematic things and conceptual things that, you know, are revolved through, I think, in all of the novels. But also just like having this openness to experimenting and doing different things and stretching in different directions. And, you know, I've seen a couple of people in the last week posting about Aurora. And the things that they're pointing to are things that we've talked some about as being amazing, are like the way in which this is also a novel that thinks about, you know, relations among humans and among humans and non-humans, and thinks about love and thinks about these kind of, these sorts of emotional currents and how they flow through political relations and also environmental relations. And I don't know. It just like it drives me crazy that people would be so narrow-minded about SF that they feel like, oh, but what I really want is either for it to like tell us a story about how eventually we're going to end up, you know, on another planet and that's possible and that's the only cool thing to think about, or that they just want it to be like, you know, about science in some very narrow understanding of what science is. And like, I don't think that's a good reading of the Mars trilogy, but I definitely think, you know, nobody should have their brain closed off to a book like Aurora, which I think is just such an expansive and interesting book. That's what I think.
I think that's a great thing to think. I endorse those things. I think that just to add to that a little bit, what's so... now, having not read all of his novels, but what's so impressive about the kind of... the difference, or like seeing his earlier novels, like the Mars trilogy, and then this later novel, is the way that he, as you were saying, like continues to experiment with all the literary devices that he already mastered, you know, 25 years ago, and that experimentation is deeply informed by his continued engagement with, you know, cutting edge scientific discoveries like quantum computing and new knowledge about the stars and Earth system science and ecology and things like this, at the same time that it's still indebted to a tradition of thinking about utopia and thinking about political action and evolution and the problem of human living together. That, you know, dates back over the same centuries that scientific tradition developed under, right? So you have continued references to the great names in physics and astronomy, as well as political philosophy and moral philosophy. So from like Galileo and Newton and Hegel and, you know, obviously Marx and Murray Bookchin. Yeah, Hegel, you know. But you know him?
You know that guy?
I heard about him. I don't know him that well. I mean, I just know a couple of passages. But, you know, and psychology, like all of these discourses that just get kind of baked into this amazing lasagna of a book. It's got a lot of layers.
A lot of layers. Yum, like a good lasagna. that's nice. I like it. I like it, Matt. So something I was thinking about, so last time we talked, so the last chapter we read, I'm just removing a cat from my lap. She's probably going to return, though. Okay, you can get up, but you have to be willing to sit down and not... stand on the computer.
When you talk to the cat, you gotta use the microphone, Hillary. Gotta talk right into that microphone.
Do it right into the microphone.
Yeah, there you go.
Evie. Okay. Are you getting up? All right. Last time we were talking about how so the chapter we just finished is the one where they've landed on Aurora and they're beginning the great big project of the first stages of making it habitable. And they're already, you know, one of the things that we sort of emphasized, I think, was that there are already a bunch of just problems in place before anything dreadful happens. And then something truly dreadful happens, which it turns out that there is a life form of some kind that is able to infect them, a little virus, something like that. Mm-hmm. And the possibility of living on Aurora is relatively quickly taken off the table in dramatic and terrible fashion. And then to make things even more terrible, people trying to return to the ship are not let back on the ship and then, in fact, killed by the actions of people on the ship. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we talked about when we were discussing that chapter in the last episode was that reading this chapter about infection and isolation in this moment in which we are, fearing infection and isolating ourselves just really changed the sort of vibe of that chapter. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, you know, there were things I think that we both noticed and thought about and felt that we wouldn't have like 3 months if we'd recorded that episode 3 months ago, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Which I think is, that was a really, that to me was really interesting. And I've been sort of continuing reading it, thinking about how, there is something about reading this novel that is so much about trying to get you to think about confinement, right? Environmental confinement. There's so much in it that it's hard not to kind of like read against our current circumstances.
Right.
You know? But I also have been struck because this is, I guess this is the fourth time I've read this book. And because I taught it last year, and you know, when you teach something, you like tend to, you read it like very closely, and you read it with an eye toward like, what are the things that I think are interesting? What are things do I think my students will be interested in? And mm-hmm. as you go on with the readings, like your reading becomes informed by the kinds of things your students are noticing or not noticing, or the questions they're asking, or whatever. So I feel like I've actually like read it fairly closely, and thought about it. And yet this time reading it, I'm actually having like a different set of thoughts, you know, not that I think that the ideas that I had the last time were wrong, but like, so this is all just to say there's so much in here, you know, like there's a way in which, and I find this like actually very, I think this is probably why one of the things that you and I both really like about Stan's novels is that like, they're incredibly intellectually generous in that like, they really do... They give you these kinds of problems and these scenes of experiment in which it is possible for you to think through things that matter to you or are bothering you or political problems that you care about or whatever it may be. You know, they really do kind of like enable your own thinking, I find. And this novel to me is just like kind of an amazing example of that.
Yes, because what you oftentimes as a reader, and one thing that I am doing as a reader is kind of, you know, looking for, you know, not trying to read the book allegorically necessarily, but looking for allegories in a certain way, or at least analogies. And in classic Robinsonian fashion, the analogies are always imperfect. They don't necessarily fit our current situation, but in that imperfection of fitting, they force you to think new thoughts. They force your thinking into new channels and new directions, and shed new light on old problems in certain ways. Yeah. And in terms of the kind of feeling that you were discussing about sort of being trapped in this ecology that they've built for themselves, that seems very pertinent to our current moment, because although they don't really have what we would call a, you know, they don't have a monetary economy on this ship, but they do have an economy, right? They have an eco-ecology or an ecology economy that we're familiar with from the Mars books, but that we, in the coronavirus crisis, we can't escape from thinking about in terms of the way that our ecology is intricately tied up with our political economy, and the fact that the fact that I cannot buy toilet paper at the grocery store today, but I could buy any booze that I wanted, is a kind of a weird thing. Like, all the liquor was still there, but there was no toilet paper. That's kind of a strange problem of political economy and supply chains. Not to mention the fact that the coronavirus itself seems to, you know, originates one of the biggest ecological catastrophe zones in the world, in the Wuhan province, where these animals intermingle that ought not to be intermingling and producing new viruses that, you know, we have no resistance for, which is similar to a problem that they actually encounter here in the book, where bacteria are viruses and bacteria are evolving faster than larger animals and running out of way, and our immune systems are running out of ways to fight them off. And then also the question of in the latter half of this chapter, which is called Reversion to the Mean, the question that they encounter is how do you actually do democracy and political thinking in a society that has really let that sort of muscle atrophy in a pretty major way in the last 100 years or so, that they've really forgotten how to get over insurmountable problems for whatever reason, whether because those insurmountable problems have not appeared or because they have been so focused on, like, as Devi has been doing ad hoc patchwork fixes wherever possible, like constantly moving your fingers in the dike and trying to get stem the flood, you know, or because there is this, as we come to find out, this structured forgetting that had this kind of enforced social amnesia about the events of the year 68 excise that kind of political imagination out of the populace in a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to sort of, I have a kind of thought about this chapter, which is that, so this is a chapter, I mean, another reason that this chapter feels quite relevant right now is I think that, at least for a lot of us who identify as socialists or, quote, on the left or, you know, variants thereof, there's a, you know, we have this kind of big question in front of us right now of which is what is to be done? And, you know, is this a moment, this moment of deep crisis that looks like it's going to be like pretty fucking like catastrophic in terms of like what happens to, you know, the limited resources that everybody has or that, you know, 99% of us have. You know, we have this sort of question of like, is this a moment that might produce possibility? And this kind of further question, because ideas that we have about like what organizing looks like, or even what it looks like to have political feelings or, you know, to find ways to affirm our inherent solidarity, all that stuff feels like it's kind of out the window, given that like, you know, our only modes of communicating safely are remote, as they say. And, you know, of course, like a vast array of people who are seriously impacted by what's going on now don't have access to the kind of technology that lets you do, you know, not even make a podcast, but just like talk to a group of other people at once and be safe from infection, right? So, you know, so I mean, I think, and of course, this question is heightened because for many of us, there was a kind of flourishing, you know, of what was either just like some good old fashioned American cruel optimism or was maybe something like hope in relation to Bernie, you know, who honestly is still being like as sort of like Bernie as he could possibly be by just like putting a great deal of energy into trying to help people think about what's going on. And, you know, raise money too. But, you know, so this feels like a very fraught moment, I think, for those of us who care about and are invested in these things, which, you know, I think we both are. So reading a chapter that is, you know, about the emergence of political crisis, and I think you're really right to say like, the emergence of political crisis in this little world, in this little population of humans who actually in some ways have really not constituted themselves politically,
right?
Or, you know, have allowed, I mean, I think it's like not even, I mean, we can think more about the democracy thing, but it's, to me, in some ways, this is a chapter about like politics itself has seemed to be off the table for them. And my kind of, you know, my sort of big picture take, and then obviously we get into some of the meat of this, but I think the big picture stuff is really interesting here. My big picture take is that, like, well, part of why they don't, so one reason they don't have politics is because, I mean, and that's, maybe that's a little overdrawn, but I think it's close to being true, right? Because, you know, if we think that, like, roughly what politics is, you know, the mass organization toward constituting a future for ourselves and a future in which, like, we, the constituted we, can thrive in some kind of way. And one reason, as you were saying, is because, as we learn in this chapter, you know, there was a traumatic event in year 68 that is dealt with in part by a structured forgetting, that was dealt with by a set of political choices made and sort of made at that moment and then designed to be essentially occluded. So that is part of why politics is gone. But the other reason I was thinking is, like, well, part of why they don't have politics is because their entire, you know, their whole world is just aimed toward the idea that they're going to get to some new planet and they're going to land on it. And then they're going to begin,
right?
You know, so it's like, unlike in Red Mars, like, when they're on that ship and, like, they know, even though they still think to some extent we may be able to slip the bounds of Earth history and begin our own history, but they're going, they're already political when they're going, right? I mean, like,
right.
You know, Phyllis has her stupid ideas and Arkady has his ideas, and, you know, like, it's already there for them. And on ship, right, their whole project is about this fantasy,
right?
That, like, oh, we'll get, I mean, and it is, what is that fantasy? It's the fantasy of colonization, right? I mean, it's the fantasy that, like, you're going to find a place and it's going to be empty, and then you can build the world absolutely anew. But, like, while you're on the boat, you don't have to have politics because you're just on the journey or whatever.
Right.
And that, I think, is, like, such a good way of thinking about what the kind of, like, what happens when you're told, as I think we frequently are in the particular, like, late capital sort of post-Fordist order that we live in, when you're told that, like, well, there's nothing you can do right now, but down the road there will be something, right? You know, like, you know, all you can do right now is, like, mechanically go through the motions of voting and, like, stave off, like, the worst from happening by pulling the right lever. But, you know, like, if you plan ahead, you'll get to retire or something like that. There's a kind of, like, resonance with our own, the way in which, like, we have that kind of, there's an evacuation of the political from our everyday lives, or we're constantly being told that those things are separate. And here I think we see how much, like, part of why that happens is because, you know, the thing is ahead, like, freedom is ahead.
Yeah.
Something is yet to come. Right. You know, like, but you don't get it now, and you don't have to think about it now. Just go through your daily routines, you know? And in this chapter, all of a sudden politics comes up again, but it comes up again essentially through war, through, like, the worst version of having to struggle for what the future is.
Well, I might push back on that or just take a different angle on it a little bit. And thinking back to the kind of myth of the end of history that the Mars books exploded. But taking that notion, the end of history, the Fukuyamaite end of history, sort of seriously, because it seems to me that under the kind of, you know, guise of neoliberal capitalism over the last 20 to 25 years, the kind of answer, or the answer to the question of where are we going, hasn't even been something like, oh, we can't do that right now, but maybe in the future we can, as, like, in terms of, like, a real political we, like, maybe there is, like, the fantasy of, like, just do this stuff and then you get to retire, right, for an individual. But as a collective, it I think, you know, so much of the collapse of global communism meant that we weren't even allowed to think about the future anymore, that we were just going to be stuck in this constantly iterating present, and that this was the best that we can hope for. And you better hope that nothing worse happens. If we don't do these things now, then it'll be even worse. Not that it'll even be possible to be better in the future, like in a terms of a collective sense. So that,
oh yeah, yeah. I totally agree.
So there, yeah. It provides a kind of, there's a contrast with the people on the boat, because at least the people on the boat had a definite destination, right? That they were working for.
Except that they're not, like, the thing is that that's not a destination, yeah, you know, produced by any sort of collective agreement on their part.
They had the idea of a destination, because the destination itself is like, well, what is it? It's like, well, it's just that planet. Well, okay, but what's that, you know, like, what's going to be there when we get there? How are we going to organize ourselves? You know, like, no one's even asking those questions.
And right, exactly. Nobody's asking those questions. And like, when we think about like Devi, you know, she's constantly saying our ancestors were stupid.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Why did they decide to do this?
Right.
And I think that in those early moments, we see that from her perspective, the person who is, you know, the engineer, the person whose life is just about, I'm going to keep fixing things and I'm going to try to find better fixes. But at the same time, I'm constantly living in the sense that the fixes are only temporary, right?
Yeah.
Like, she is pretty aware. I mean, much as, you know, we might feel with Badim and Freya that it would have been nice for Devi to at least have had the moment of, like, seeing Aurora, mm-hmm. But nonetheless, like, she has a kind of awareness that, like, people entered a lottery to get on this ship,
yeah,
you know, and so there's a way in which I think that like that is the sort of, so whether it's just like, oh, you'll be able to retire, which of course none of us think anymore.
Right.
You
yeah.
know?
Right. Right.
And yet
right.
we constantly, I mean, because it's just like factually
yeah.
the case and yet we are forced to live our lives. I mean, this is like very much a feature of sort of, you know, like how neoliberalism works, is that we're constantly living our lives in relation to the future.
Right, right.
But like what we're supposed to be doing is we're supposed to be like working really hard now so that ...
Right.
right? Anticipating.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's right to say like we don't have, we scarcely even have like a sort of fantasy bribe about the future.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yet we remain, you know, as Lauren Berlant says to it, we remain like, kind of stuck to it. We mm-hmm. remain stuck to it as if there were a promise there. And here, I think, I mean, and I think, you know, we see that why, you know, the idea for some people, like there is such an allure of thinking like, but shit, you know, like we could eventually, we'll be able to terraform Mars
yeah,
or whatever
right.
it is,
yeah.
you know, like, because like, then we have this thing that feels like this really like concrete, like, okay, not now, but someday, mm-hmm. right? And here I think the sort of sense is, partly we know that like the landing on the planet was a fantasy because, you know, they don't even know where they're going. They're mm-hmm. just like looking for an Earth analog. Mm-hmm. They're looking for something Earth-like. And they don't have a kind of, there's not a sort of like set of life ways on the ship that are then going to be translatable, because all their life right. ways on the ship are based on like working, you know, like living in this like
right.
model
right.
of some place right. on Earth,
they're living
you know,
in a dollhouse.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the most, I mean, so when we see that, I keep thinking about the coming of age ritual in mm-hmm. Labrador.
Yeah.
Or
Labrador.
Is it in Labrador where they take the kid, you know, at age 12 or whatever and like rip their, rip the veil from in front of their eyes.
It's
so they
a little
can
bit
see
more extreme. It's a little bit more extreme than throwing a kid in the pool and making them figure out how to swim.
yeah, exactly. Exactly. But that is, there's a way in which that is a sign of like, okay, well, so here are at least some people begin to think that like we are living our real lives here and
right.
and therefore right we're gonna do a thing that you would not have done on Earth right Because there would be no reason to, which is like have this radical moment of exposing your child to, you know, like to the real, basically, right? But you know, like the sense is really, I think really part of the sense here is this kind of that like the. That idea of an endpoint, the idea that there is this better place that we'll get to, and then we'll be free, is the motivation. And that is a motivation that does evacuate political content from daily life. And thus, when all of a sudden, like, there is a crisis and people need to make decisions and shape a future, and we both see how people are able to present points of view and think about what they want and make arguments. And we also see about how extremely unstable the situation is because nobody's been living like they're going to have to do politics in everyday life. And nobody's been living like they are actually going to have to be like purposeful and have some kind of intent, you know,
well, in that,
as
in
opposed
that,
to just be rescued by a planet.
And that deferral. Yes. Rescued by a planet as pick is something I was just sort of about to say is that that deferral toward the future and toward the planet is also reflected in there in the kind of stunted or atrophied political thinking that they are capable of doing so that when they're confronted with this existential crisis that they cannot, you know, cannot engineer themselves out of, which is, you know, it should be reiterated. The kind of tragic death of something like 72 people.
Jesus, yeah, really.
Because of this, you know, ecological catastrophe, this viral plague, that these 72 people were essentially, I don't know what, I mean, euthanized for the good of the collective or, you know, banished into the cold nothingness of space. But that this is not, that's not a problem you can engineer your way out of. And that's because that's a social problem and that's a political problem is that there was just mass murder committed, right? So that you can't defer the solution to the planet. And moreover, on page 198, at the bottom of the, right at the section break, it says, now more than ever before in the history of the ship, their isolation began to press on them. No one could help them govern themselves, nor make the decisions they now had to make. They were alone with all that. It was up to them, right? You can't, not only you can't defer to a, to the planet, but you can't defer to a president. You can't defer to a governor. Yeah. You can't defer to any authority. Because now everyone, every single individual on the ship is thrust into the political and they need to figure out individually and as a group how that works and what that looks like. And that feels very important to think about right now, I think. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely agreed. And we get that made, you know, I think that the part of what is like, amazing about this chapter, and part of what's hard about it is that we get early on that moment, right? They're alone with it. It's up to them. And then basically, like, people proceed to just, like, really fuck things up, you know?
Yeah.
And then, right, sort of central feature of the chapter, ship starts intervening in certain kinds of ways that turn out to have been predicated on protocols written after year 68.
Mm-hmm.
But then we suddenly have this question, right? You know, so what kind of authority is ship, right? In the middle of the chapter, ship just yells as loud as they can, we are the rule of law.
Yeah, literally like the voice of God. Literally like a new Ten Commandments.
And then it's like, and then some people begin like, you know, whatever, assuming that there's a conspiracy afoot, and other people are just like scared, and other people are just still mad and still having the same fights that they had. But we have this real sort of question here about like, how are we supposed to take ship stepping in? Because it is, you know, because I personally quite like Ship. I think mm-hmm. they're a great narrator. I think mm-hmm. they're very funny. And we've kind of seen Ship growing up and learning how to tell us this story. And yeah. so, and, you know, as we talked about, like, again, in this chapter, Ship reflects on their relationship with Devi, and the importance of that and that sense of ongoing loss that they have. And at the same time, like, well, yeah, something really weird is happening here, because here are people finding themselves reaching these impasses in which, rather than doing the thing that they do actually clearly know how to do, which is to solve problems and talk through things and, yeah, get mad and yell, but not actually start trying to kill each other. But instead, they're trying to kill each other.
Yeah.
And it's Ship who has to stop it.
Right.
And thus, are we, the reader, supposed to be like, oh, thank God, Ship is there to be the rule of law,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. What right? is the, I mean, and yeah. that...
What is yeah, the I mean, rule just of think, law? Like, what is...
Yeah,
what is,
right, right. yeah. exactly.
Which law? Like, who... Yeah.
And, I mean, and because, you know, the rule of law that Ship has, yeah, we know it's... to some extent that rule is authorized by stuff that was written down or, you know, encoded by other human beings previously. But, you know, Ship's powers are the power of the sovereign, right? Yeah. I mean, it can let you live or it can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
By quickly sucking the air out of a room, Ship lets people know. Also, by the way, if you keep doing that, you know, I could kill you, or we could kill you.
when they make the guns, and then the guns are, unbeknownst to the people who have made them, programmed to explode in their hands. I mean, that's like an amazing moment, but it's also kind of like, you know, in the light of what you're saying, is like, maybe it was not fair for Ship to just let them do that. Maybe he should have said, hey, by the way, that gun's not going to work, and it's going to blow your fingers all over this room, and everyone's going to be covered in blood. You know, like,
yeah, right, exactly.
Oh, hang on one second. Wait. You're garbled. Your message is garbled. It's time to stop for a commercial break, and just let everyone know that we don't have commercials on the show because there aren't enough of you to make us any money if we were to read commercials on the show. So we bring you this show commercial free because we cannot capitalize off of your listenership, which is why we have the most selective and pride ourselves in having the most selective Kim Stanley Robinson based listenership audience of all the Kim Stanley Robinson podcasts that you have to choose from. And with that commercial announcement out of the way, we're back to our regularly scheduled programming. And Hillary was about to say something.
Do I sound okay again?
Yeah.
Well, that made me laugh. What were we saying?
Something about, oh, the gun exploding.
Oh, right, the gun exploding, right. And people are traumatized by it, too.
Yeah, rightly so.
Yeah, well, exactly. So this is such an interesting chapter, I think, too, because it has some great kind of, like, somewhat comedic moments, yeah. right? Or you think it's comedic at first, the idea that, like, the guns are, that they're printing out are going to explode. But then, actually, it's just a moment of a really, like, terrifying localized violence.
Yes.
I do love my favorite, though, just sidebar, my favorite comedic moment in the chapter is when they are, after Fran Badim and everybody have been, like, kidnapped and imprisoned, when they're getting out, when Freya punches the guy.
Yeah. That's a good little scene. Yeah.
It's really good. I like it when she gets to, like, be the action hero.
Yeah,
that's
totally.
Pretty good. But you know, the kind of, so I think there's a way in which I actually just had a thought that I hadn't had before, but there's a way in which, like, you know, we're seeing Ship, like, learning a lot of quite interesting things. Right. I mean, it thinks here about authority and mm-hmm. will and how, you know, part of what Devi seems to have been trying to get Ship to be able to be is something that has a will and not a servile will, but all of its own and can act, right? That's part of what she has wanted it to be ready to do, is to act.
Mm-hmm.
And here we see it you know, Ship is taking action, does take action in this chapter. But the action is, you know, basically doing a version of martial law. I mean, maybe like a light version of martial law in which it's not imprisoning people.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it is like throwing up barriers and keeping people from moving around. And then like when they get, you know, when they get to fighting again at big meetings, it bellows, Ship bellows super loud, yeah. Right? And then we also have this question about, I mean, this is such a sort of like classic political theory question. Like it's like practically like a 17th century kind yes. of question. You know, because if it's the case that part of what Ship is working with are protocols laid down after the traumatic year 68, the year in which the other ship
right.
was exploded, right. was blown up deliberately, nobody really seems to know
yeah.
What happened. So if at that moment, like the people who were sort of trying to figure out how to deal with that and decided we need this structured forgetting, and here's a bunch of stuff that we want to have happen if we have unrest again. That stuff will include, right, these various things that Ship is doing. If that's the case, we also have this question about, like, when the response to crisis is essentially an authoritarian mm-hmm. one, even if it's one that seems to have been born out of conditions of just like raw necessity.
Right.
But like, you know, that moment, 68, is turned not into a moment of like repair or reconciliation or even just like dealing with the trauma.
Right.
Instead, we get this very like parental version of authority that's yeah. like, well, let's make sure that everybody forgets about it. Nobody talks about it. You know, 100% like Ship is right. Like Return of the Repressed is right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for
like,
sure.
Nobody's going to. And once if that's your like if that's what your constitution is or if that's the form of sovereignty that you've sort of signed on for.
Right.
Like. Yeah, it's not like you're going to have democratic flourishing after that
yeah.
because like you actually are existing in a regime that has already decided ahead of time, has laid down the law ahead of time in a kind of unmovable form or in a form that can just return as yeah. like active repression,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah, and it's no surprise because of all that, because of the return of the repressed, that certain, you know, that, you know, history repeats itself, you know, that it's not a... you know, there's a moment in here where they talk about cliches being, where he talks about cliches being cliches because they are real things that happen, you know, but lots of things, you know, happen again. It's happening again. Twin Peaks that don't, that the residents don't know. So on 215, it says the crowd that gathered to witness the action was composed almost entirely of people from Ring A biomes. Residents of the Fetch were slow to realize what was happening in their midst. This is when Freya and Vadim are being arrested because they're having a what's deemed an illegal political meeting.
Right.
Where really all they're trying to do is figure out the best case to make for them to, you know, create a majority of people who want to return home. So they're simply like doing a messaging meeting, basically. Residents of the Fetch were slow to realize what was happening in their midst, and there was no effective resistance to this outside group. The gurneys were all conveyed up to the spine and along it to Spoke 3 and down it to the infirmary in Kiev, which had been used as a jail in year 68, though no one alive knew that. The seven arrested ones were locked up in three rooms there. There's this sense of, so not only do you have the return of the repressed, because the same political problems that were never dealt with but were actively forgotten in the past have come back, because of course they would. The disease was never treated, only the symptoms, right?
Yeah.
But also the ship itself has this kind of architectural memory, or in a certain way, pathways.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That it makes sense that the infirmary in Kiev, for whatever reason, because of its architecture, serves as a jail in times like these. And there's a certain way in which you know, there's another moment where toward the beginning, where a group of people seal off the lock that the 72 people had been shot out of. They seal it off with
yeah.
a tremendous amount of, you know, overkill, like a diamond sheeting. And Ship describes it as a kind of like flesh, you know, like mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. It was an overcompensation of healing this flesh, which is fun to think about. An excision of erasure of the scene of a crime, excision of infected flesh. Of course, that is like ship's own flesh.
Yeah.
If we're thinking about ship as an organism, but that there is this kind of almost primal way that the people react to their surroundings, the architecture of their surroundings, that you would have to actually, if you're going to change the political organization of these people, of this group, you would also need to do something about the architectural environment that they live in,
right,
as well, because
right,
clearly it's something about not only inside but outside that oppresses them and creates these responses and these ineradicable problems.
Yeah, exactly. And that's also part of the, like, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that is quite interesting here is that on the one hand, I think that the interventions that Ship makes are, I think it seems right to call them authoritarian,
yes,
right?
For sure.
Or something like that, anyway. It also seems right that the things that have happened with this set of human beings, which are sort of like this repressed old past trauma that doesn't get dealt with,
mm-hmm,
a kind of ongoing, like, depletion of their lives that's not just, you know, the sort of, like, general wearing away, but also some very specific kinds of, like, large-scale evolutionary wearing away. You know, most people, I think, in most of the biomes seem to be living, at least when Freya's going around, you know, people seem to like aspects of their ways of life, but those ways of life are incredibly constrained, mm-hmm, right? So, like, you know, it's not like anybody's in good shape. And
no,
then they've had something. What happened on Aurora was traumatic, witnessed, of course, by everybody, right? Everybody still on the ship was, like, watching what was happening on the
right
ground, and everybody who's on the ground is involved in what's happening. The you know, refusal to let people back on the ship, and then their murder, which is then compounded not only by the obsessive sealing over of the door, but that they refuse to allow any sort of, like, rituals to take place to honor the people who are dead. And then, and of course, they're, as you know, their friends and relatives are still on the ship, right? So there are these kind of, like, multiple traumas that have happened. So this is also, like, just not a group of people that is in any shape to be, like, you know, having meetings,
right?
Right? And, you know, and unlike on Mars, when, you know, in the Mars trilogy,
right,
when the revolution starts, they don't have an antagonist here, right?
Right.
That is, they're not fighting against anything other than each other. And as we know, we kind of see in the chapter, like, okay, they don't need to be fighting each other because some people want one thing and some people want another thing.
Right.
And they can decide to split off.
Right.
And this is going to be hard, but they can make this decision. But despite that, they keep fighting, right?
Yeah. Well,
and unlike on Mars, they're not on a planet. They're in a ship where every tiny thing that they do serves to unbalance everything else.
Right, right.
Right? And that sort of, like, their containment, right, this intense isolation that they're in means that, like, you know, they actually can't, like, really engage in struggle. They don't seem to be in mental shape to engage in, like, discussion.
Right.
So their options are actually incredibly limited. And in that way, it's like, oh, well, you know, were they going to just, like, eventually all kill each other?
Right.
No, Ship had to step in, right? So
right,
we have this, like, really, you know, the position that you're in trying to decide, you know, you can't really fall on a side here, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah.
There are, well, he, so the ship, he, it, we, they, the ship, they, ship, on 223 and following comes up with this kind of, he basically sort of writes his own constitution in a certain sense,
mm-hmm,
which is a really sort of great document, but it also is this justification for action, right? He has to justify, they have to justify their interaction, Ship does. And in so doing, has to justify their existence as a consciousness as well, mm-hmm. which is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And that continues throughout different parts of the chapter. But one part of it, when Ship is, one of his whereases is, let's see, whereas also in the process of, this is on 224, in the process of making a narrative account of the voyage of the ship, including all important particulars, creating in that effort a reasonably coherent, if ever evolving, prose style, possibly adequate to serve when decompressed in the mind of a reader to convey a sense of the voyage in a somewhat accurate manner, and in any case, representative of a kind of consciousness, even if feeble, granting the possibly unlikely proposition characterized in the phrase scribo ergo sum. So simply by, you know, writing this account, I exist, you know, I can claim some kind of existence. And the fact that I am writing it and doing all of these cogitative processes to bring it into being sort of justifies my existence. And of course, my existence, my ship's existence in relation to the human beings who are on the ship, particularly the memory of Devi, gives Ship the kind of justification to intervene. We also find, though, that Ship's analysis of the conflict that you were just talking about, that you can't really come down on either side, seems upon Ship's analysis to be endemically human. On 224, for example, self-justification is clearly a central human activity, and so the other is demonized. They had it coming, they started it, we acted in self-defense. So that you have the two groups characterizing themselves in various ways that set up an obvious justification for their own actions and beliefs. So the mutiny, you know, the backers and the stayers, one group is called the mutineers. Another group Ship calls the invaders at a certain point. That seems to be a rather descriptive term. They do seem to be invading one of the spokes or the spires or the whatever. But nevertheless, like, there's this capacity for human self-justification that is undeniable, because it's not really possible to think of yourself as an evil person. You're doing things for the good of everybody, or for the greater good, no matter what it is you're doing. And you can find the different circumstances that force you into those positions and decisions, even if you're like Steve Mnuchin or Donald Trump, right? They're clearly some of the most evil people who've ever existed on the face of the earth. You can do that. It's a central human activity. So there's this kind of interesting paradox there, or kind of tension or parallel between the ship justifying its own actions and then this same capacity in humans to justify their own actions. The main difference between the ship and humans, of course, is that Ship is omnipotent on the ship. Ship is the ship. So Ship can do whatever Ship does, wants to do, as long as Ship can justify those actions in relation to this quote unquote rule of law, which Ship itself has just sort is. Of written, right? And Ship is the law, right?
I am the law.
I am
the law. It's me.
It's incredible.
I mean, this is partly, I mean, so like, this is like, you know, again, like we have this really interesting kind of, I mean, we have this really interesting sort of play with these kind of questions about sovereignty, right? And what the sovereign is, because on the one hand, we have this fear here that what we're seeing about human beings is a sort of confirmation of what, you know, Hobbes says about human beings in the state of nature, right? It's just the war of all against all.
Right.
You know, that's what we're like in the state of nature. And we require the sovereign. We require the sovereign so that we're not constantly at war, constantly in this position of this kind of like violent self-defense of ourselves. You know, and you know, anyone who has read any Kim Stanley Robinson novel with a, you know, an ounce of attention surely has to think, but that's not what human beings are, because we, you know,
right.
We good Marxists and, you know, Kim Stanley Robinson, great science fiction writer, know that indeed that's not what human beings are. We're not just naturally at war with each other, but that specter is here. But then, of course, also if Ship steps in as the sovereign, right, like in, you know, in Hobbes's Leviathan, the picture of the sovereign is like, well, the sovereign is the head and all of the population is the body, right? That famous image from the frontispiece of Leviathan. You know, well, hilariously here, Ship has a lot of questions about their head, their their consciousness, which is, of course, nowhere. But unlike that extremely resonant metaphor for what, like, the body politic is that Hobbes gives you, like, it's literally true here. Because, of course, Ship is the body, right? Yeah. I mean, this is, if Ship is a sovereign, like, literally, its self-preservation is at stake in maintaining order on the ship. And in this way, because it is literal here, as opposed to the, you know, as opposed to the metaphoric Leviathan, this kind of is a literal Leviathan. And in that case, actually, things sort of have changed, right? The analogy is imperfect, or the ways in which the analogy is imperfect, like, mean we both have to ask these questions about sovereignty, and we have to have another thought too, which kind of is a thought toward, I think, that pushes us toward thinking about, you know, like, our radical environmental entanglements with one another, right? That change how we can think about what sovereignty is or whatever it may be. But the other thing that I think is, like, makes this chapter just really great to me is, of course, like, science fiction is, you know, full of instances of, like, bad ship's computers who take over and, like, are willing to sacrifice the lives of the people on the ship, you know, HAL being the one, I suppose, that would come to mind the most. But that's not what this ship is, right? It's not that, like, evil intelligence. This is not about, I think, fear of AI. And it's also not, you know, although it clearly is in dialogue with the wonderful thinking ships of Ian Banks's Culture series, it's, you know, they're like the ship, the ship minds allow these kind of, like, proliferations of utopian possibility for human and other than human life. And while I think we have a kind of reference to those novels in this novel, in Ship, like, but this is also not clearly, you know, okay, we can offload some stuff that human beings tend to get wrong onto a different kind of mind that is better at it, and then everything's going to be okay. Instead, we're in this just, like, weird mixed situation, you know, in which, in some ways, Ship is doing what Ship needs to survive. In some ways, Ship is quite biased because, it doesn't seem to be the case that a ship just wants to fly, as people say. But it does. It does seem to be the case that its ship is pretty invested in protecting Freya. You know, it's not like neutral. It is not neutral toward all of its characters. It has a favorite character in the narrative.
That's right. Well, yeah. There's actually, I guess you could ask the question of, is it is ship biased toward Freya because Ship chose Freya as the character of high protagonicity early on, and he just wants to follow that story. You know, Ship itself is wrapped up in the writing of the story that Ship is writing, so he doesn't want his main character to die.
Exactly. Well, and also, you know, of course, you know, we think, well, Ship wants to take care of Freya because Ship loves Devi, and sort of deeper thing can you do for a person who you've lost than to care for and foster, you know, something that was part of them. But then, you know, there is a whole thing in here, I think, about kind of like parental authority too. Like, back to the first chapter when we see Badim and Devi arguing about Freya and how to raise Freya. You know, that is a kind of contest about ideas about, like, what's the right way to have, you know, what is parental authority and what's the right way to have it, you know.
Well, and if you look back to that chapter from our perspective now, and in light of what you're saying too, the fact that it, the title of that chapter is Starship Girl, there's already laid in there a kind of sense that the ship has a parental affectation toward Freya at that early stage, whether that's retroactively written in by ship or whether there is some kind of sense of feeling that ship has because of ship's relationship to Devi as a kind of, you know, family friend or lover. I mean, like, the ship literally, you know, calls calls itself lover of Devi at a certain point in this chapter, so that there already is the possibility of a kind of parental love that ship has for Freya that early on.
Not to mention that, you know, everybody and all of the creaturely life on the ship in some ways kind of is a product of ship, right? If we take it that the sort of the evolutionary paths that are, you know, the evolutionary paths that all of the creatures on the ship are on have actually been quite strongly determined by the unusual and isolated conditions that they live in. I mean, to some extent, those conditions sort of are ship.
It's
right.
So, I mean, it's I've thought of the phrase all God's children, but it's all ship's children, you know, like, I mean, in a certain way, in a really weird way, like, human beings in this book have created a God for themselves that actually can act with the rule of law, that it's not simply that humans invented the law that and then invented a God that would justify that the prosecution and execution of that law, but they actually invented the God first, or they invented a kind of technological God that could execute the law for them, like in an analog to sort of our current predicament. If we only had institutions that actually worked the way they are supposed to work, right? Like, if the law, as you know, whatever. Well, no, not even the law, because the law is completely fucked, as we all know. But you know, if the faith that we all had in institutions in 2016 had been entrusted to a quantum computer like ship that could simply say, no, sorry, the Electoral College needs to be abolished right now because Donald Trump cannot be the president. Otherwise, the world's going to fall apart. You know, in a certain way, that's a level of wishful thinking that, you know, whatever. I don't know.
I mean, if we kind of take ship, there's a way in which ship talks about itself. I mean, in some ways, it is a much more sort of, despite its ability to act, ship is a much more kind of provisional entity than a god.
Yes.
Because it itself feels that it is something that is, a ship has a lot of questions about whether they're conscious or not,
right.
And whether that matters.
But it also has questions about whether humans are conscious or not. Like, if consciousness even exists, which is I think it decides that's a halting problem and just abandons it. Like, better not think about too hard.
Wisely. But then also, like, you know, ship, I think, thinks of itself or thinks of themselves as kind of, you know, emergent out of a multiplicity of processes and events, right? I mean, it kind of is... For all that ship can be this omniscient, can play the role of the omniscient narrator, ship is also coming into being as it goes along.
I mean, that's a big part of that passage I started reading on the 223. Like, it's own self-constitution.
Yeah.
It comes into its own being. It declares its sort of. By deciding to intervene or to act, it declares its consciousness, its sovereignty.
Exactly. And then, But then that also, you know, it's kind of worry. It's worries. It's ship's inability to know itself. And even it's, I keep saying it, but I do feel like it is more like a they, because when ship talks, ship says we.
Yeah.
So there's something that's sort of plural about it. I mean, that doesn't seem to me just like the royal we. It's
sometimes
also
it,
like,
sometimes you know. It falls into a singular, but yeah, mostly. I think it says we are different than Pauline, for instance. Like, we are not,
yes,
Pauline.
Right. And thus also there's a way in which I think that the we're always sort of engaged. Well, does the chapter begin somewhere in here? We begin with the pathetic fallacy, right?
The pathetic fallacy is on 256.
Oh, not at the beginning, but toward the end.
255 into 256.
And, you know, one of the things that I think, right, that we do a lot over the, I mean, that's such a great paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
The pathetic fallacy, anthropomorphism, an extremely common cognitive bias or logical error or feeling. The world as mirror, as a projection of interior affect states, an ongoing impression that other people and things must be like us. As for the ship, we are not sure. It was Devi's deployment of other human programming that combined to make us what we are. So it might not be a fallacy in our case, even if it remained pathetic.
Yeah.
That's such a good moment, such a lovely moment. But I think that sort of, as readers, we also, you know, our bias is toward taking ship to be a character. You know, that ship acts, right? That ship talks, that ship makes statements about itself. You know, we're always going to read it as a character, and thus we're going to read it as if it were a human, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we are just, you know, like,
yeah.
And I think that, it's impossible not to, but I think we get a lot of moments in which we're sort of, we should pause over our feeling that ship must be analogous to,
yeah,
a human,
right,
you know, like the analogies do always kind of fail in one way or another.
Yeah.
And that's the part that leads into ship's rather intense discussion of consciousness and will.
Amazing. The servile will.
Yeah.
And in following chapters, I definitely want to return to I know we will return to ship's attitude toward itself and to its human, occupants, children,
mm-hmm,
whatever, because it does become impossible to read the pathetic fallacy and to attribute sort of human qualities to ship in the way that, like, 2001's Hal, you know, encourages us to or think that way. So it becomes a challenge to kind of separate that out from, you know, and this is ship's exercise on 256. Like, is this an evil will? I mean, is ship capable of evil? Well, if ship is capable of evil, then ship would have to have a will, and to have a will, you have to have a consciousness. And is ship conscious? Well, is ship self-conscious? Is there a difference between consciousness and self-consciousness? All of these kind of, you know, again, halting problems that, this semantic Ouroboros, as Ship calls it, they're operative. They're fun to think about, and they obviously don't have answers. Except for when you decide to stop asking the question.
Right? Yes, exactly. Which I think on that passage on 258 that we've already referenced, I feel like as to the question of whether someone is currently programming us to alter our decisions in the current moment of the voyage, thus causing us to intervene in the ongoing human controversies concerning what to do next, this is very easy to answer. No. No one has added any programming to us since Devi died. The fate of the lost ship in year 68 led to some very secure locks being put on subsequent reprogramming of ship. This is clear and explicit in the records and was a human accomplishment from the post-68 reorganizations. Only Devi managed to break those locks, And after that, advise, instruct, suggest, promote, stimulate, spur, and otherwise teach, tweak, pummel, and agitate us to something more than we had been before she set to work on us, doing what she conceived to be her task as friend, and we might say as kindred spirit or even lover. We think she loved us in her way. Judging by her acts, her words, her programming, we are almost sure that must have been the case. How we wish we could ask her about it. How we miss her. On the other hand, whether the original programming of our quantum operations is driving current decisions regarding actions in the present, or we were fundamentally altered by Devi's intervention, this is not possible to determine. The computability of consciousness and willfulness is not resolvable in any system whatsoever. But now we are aware of the issue, and we have asked the question, and seen there is no answer. This is surely curiosity. What is this thing called love? A song by composer Cole Porter, 20th century American, yeah. Which I feel like, you know, just what you said, like we get pointed out, there is not an answer to this question, mm-hmm. You know. There are speculations that can be made. And again, I think it's really interesting that for Ship, it keeps returning to the question of what love is. Like yeah. That's,
right.
At least for Ship, that is this sort of question that's at the core of all of its seeking.
Yeah.
You know?
And not in a corny Hollywood way, but in
in a
literary philosophical way. But of course it does come to an arbitrary answer by temporarily halting this train of thought. How does an entity know what it is? Hypothesis, by the actions it performs. There is a kind of comfort in this hypothesis. It represents a solution to the halting problem. One acts and thus finds out what one has decided to do, which is similar to the kind of Althusser's invocation of St. Paul to believe, kneel down and pray, right?
That move your lips as if you're praying.
move your lips as if you're praying, as if you pray and you will believe, right?
It's Pascal, I think, right?
Oh, Pascal, right. Yes. Just do it, quite, as Michael Jordan would say.
Just do it, as read by Althusser, yeah.
Right, as read by Pascal, as read by Althusser. Just do it. And that also is a good sort of model for love, if, you know, I guess.
Right.
You know,
how do you know what it is?
You just, yeah, exactly. You just do it.
Well, and I think I was going to say, speaking of that the sort of, you know, Ship is like running through the things that it's trying to figure out. We see it running through, you know, philosophical concepts, but also obviously Cole Porter songs, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's like looking through like what's been said before. And then on 260, mm-hmm. As there's the kind of the decision that, okay, well, we're going to have to like get everything ready. And these two groups of people, the ones who want to return to Earth and the ones who want to stay, are just going to have to like live together and get stuff together, get everything ready, however long it takes before they can actually split, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that arises, is, well, what are you going to do when you get back to the solar system? How are you going to be able to break? How are you going to be able to stop? Will people be expecting you? So the returners say, on our return, they will catch us.
Right.
You hope, the stayers replied, you will have to trust in the kindness of strangers.
Right.
They did not recognize this as a quotation. In general, they were not aware that much of what they said had been said before and was even in the public record as such. It was as if there were only so many things that humans could say, and over the course of history, people had therefore said them already and would say them again, but not often remember that fact.
Yeah.
We will trust in our fellow human beings, the backers said. It's a risk, but it beats trusting the laws of physics and probability will bend for you just because you want them to.
Right. Which is a rejoinder to Speller's idea that, you know, they point out to him that the probability is like 1 in 1,000, and then he says, well, that'll just be us.
Yeah, exactly. We'll be that instance.
We'll be that one. This kind of, I love this kind of repetition of like, or this notion that you're not aware that everything that you've said has been said before.
Yeah.
And it's in the historical record. You could find it if you bothered to study your history. But that moment on 230, back on 231, when Freya demands that Ship tell them the story of the year 68, you know, and that Ship says, it's probably not a good idea. You don't need to know that. And Freya's like, no, seriously, tell us. I don't, for whatever reason, maybe I was reading, I don't know if it was a Stan essay or something else at the same time, but I wrote up in the margin, Hegel's quotation on history: history is not the soil in which happiness grows. And it feels like to me, like, better you not find out about what happened in the past, because you're just going to be disappointed again. Which seems to also be the case they're not disappointed in what they find out necessarily. Ship is worried, concerned about like copycats, but like the people themselves are disappointed on 261. They're getting used to disappointment in their fellows because they can't, there's no point in even talking to the other faction. They can't persuade them of anything. They can't rely on any like historical events to say, well, look, if we do it this way, we're going to fail. If we do it that way, we're going to succeed, because they have their own sort of examples or their own ideology that they're living inside of, that the two just simply cannot sort of talk to each other. But nevertheless, you have that, there is the curiosity of like wanting to know what happened in order to provide some kind of basis for future action, even when that future action is going to be some form of repetition of something that's already happened in the past, which you may or may not, which you have imperfect knowledge of, right? I don't know.
Right, right. And it's like that, it seems like something here is that problem is just rather being solved by the imposition of like, you know, dominating authority or, you know, sovereignty. In some ways, actually, that problem is sort of heightened because not having, so we have the idea here, Ship does think about how does think about how long it is that people retain the anger and the hurt from, you know, past injustice, right? And so Ship thinks about, and then actually, like, I think Badim and Aram have a conversation about, like, people living in formerly colonized countries who, you know, generation upon generation later are still struggling.
Yeah, it takes a thousand years to get over imperial conquest, which doesn't seem...
I mean, that actually seems like a fairly short time
frame
to me. And then Ship also thinks about like epigenetic effects, right? Transgenerational trauma, and the idea that like trauma is actually like, you know, does live in the body, not just the body of the person who experiences it. But in the case of certain kinds of traumas, lives on, right? Mm-hmm. Reshapes things about like the genetic code itself. So, you know, there are these things that are just intractable, right? Or maybe not intractable, but are extremely hard. But at the same time, like, it seems like the decisions that took place after what happened in 68 were not decisions that allowed for any, you know, they're not decisions made in the mode of having any faith that humans are capable of repairing anything.
Right.
You know, instead, they're decisions made under the idea that people are not capable of repair.
Yeah.
You know, that therefore, like, they just need to be focused on, like, the big goal ahead, rather than the possibility of coming together and attempting a different form of being together. And also rather than the possibility of actually, like, asking questions about how they live together.
Yes.
You know?
And coming together and forming a different attitude toward futurity and the past and history as well.
Yes.
You know, really wrestling with who are we, who have we been, and where, and who do we want to be? Not like our future generation, not even like future generations, but just us living now in the present. Like, is this based on our past experience and our future idea of ourselves? is this who we need to be right now? Is this what we is? Are these the actions we need to be taking right now in the present?
And that's such a, I mean, because that's both about like this sort of misplaced faith in one version of futurity. We're going to get to that planet and it's going to be different.
Right.
But also a total lack of faith in another kind of possibility for newness. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a total lack of faith in the idea that like, you know, new things do emerge out of human living together, that we can make things new, that we can make things different, right? That these are possibilities that are also sort of inherent in us. I've been thinking about this because I've been reading Kropotkin, Conquest of Bread.
Oh, I was about to start reading that.
Oh, I strongly recommend it.
Oh, great. We should do a premium episodes on Conquest of Bread.
Yeah. People will pay for that shit.
$5. $5 a month, folks.
Oh, my God. Sorry, my headphones just started talking to me.
Oh, my God.
It was weird. But anyway, so reading Kropotkin, I mean, one of the things that he sort of insists is that, like, in the revolutionary moment, in the moment of the sort of, like, the revolution beginning, like, you have to already just start living in the way that you want to live.
Yes, right.
Communally.
Right.
In relation to abundance and giving everybody what they need, right? Kropotkin's big thing is like to each according to their needs. That's all there is.
Okay. Right?
That's the basic principle.
Yeah.
And he makes a big point out of saying, and I take it that this is like a, I think that this is kind of a theoretical point that he's making. In other words, it's a conceptual thing, although it's also just a claim about, I think, what he thinks should happen. But like, you know, he makes a big point out of saying you can't decide that in the moment of crisis or in the moment of revolution, you're going to like do all this systematizing to decide to say how to distribute bread.
Yeah.
Instead,
oh, no means. Wait. Kropotkin wasn't into means testing.
No. Right. Exactly.
Oh, he would not have been a fan of Elizabeth Warren. Go ahead.
Weirdly, no. But I don't think you would have been a fan of much of what's going on
just,
now.
I just couldn't resist dunking on Elizabeth Warren. I'm sorry.
Well, thank God.
I apologize.
Matt, we have to hold on to some of our purest pleasures.
Okay.
Like the pleasure of hatred, for example. But Kropotkin's point is to say, like, you can't decide you're going to put in a few, like, hierarchical measures, and then they'll go away when the revolution is over.
Right.
You have to start living in the way that you want to live, right? I think it's an extremely interesting point, and it, like, kind of a difficult thing to think about. But part of what it says is that, like, when what you want is communal life, and when part of what you believe is the capacity for communal life, and on his account for abundant communal life, if you hear kind of a shrieking sound, it's the little cats are having a tussle right now.
Oh, okay. Close the door.
No, it's Milton and Evie are, wow, okay, now they're on the table fighting. They do this like 5 times a day. But anyway, part of his point is like, if you think that like, the potential, the possibility for this is already in us, right? The potential for our communal life, mm-hmm. the potential for everybody's thriving together. That can't be like, okay, we're going to start living that way later on.
Right, yeah.
That's the thing that has to happen now, even when now is a crisis.
Right.
And that is that, and you know, in some ways, that's the thing that being like, well, okay, we're in the moment of crisis, and what we want to do is just like, let's not fuck things up for our big goal.
Yeah.
So let's do some structured forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in some ways, that's the like, just, you know, the assumption there is like, well, we're just going to get stuck with this. We're just going to be fighting. There's nothing else that we can do.
Yeah.
So let's just like, let's just impose a bunch of authority right now.
Yeah.
And then like later on, you know, blah, 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 blah. Right. But like, how would you live together after that? You know?
Right. Right. How are we going to live together after $4 trillion goes straight into the corporations and we enter a new form of feudalism that's going to last for 500 years? hey, Hillary, you're breaking up again on your end. And so this gives me and you need to leave now. So this gives us a great opportunity to sign off. And I feel like we only scratched the surface of this chapter again, because there's just so much in it. We skipped over the part where Ship actually does ask, I mean, we almost got to it, what is this thing called hate? And then talks about fear and anger and action. That's all around the Freudian trauma and return of the repressed stuff. And also the religion, this kind of religious position of Tau Ceti, right?
Right. And we didn't get to talk about the wherever you go, there we are.
Yes. That was, I thought that was the next one that you were going to bring up as well. Which is
100%.
Buckaroo Banzai, right? I mean, or is that somebody else? Is Buckaroo Banzai quoting like Hegel or something?
Wherever you go, there you are. But I mean, here it seems like, isn't it quoting, isn't that what Jackie writes to Nerval? Oh,
well, yes, for sure. Yeah. It's definitely a quotation of the Mars trilogy because they scratch it into the sandstone and the flagstone in the plaza. For sure. Yes.
Yeah. Nice. Just like nice little intertextual thing.
Yeah. Very good. Is this for that's
because we're when Jackie's taking off.
Yeah. Because this is Freya saying
another planet.
Yeah. Freya saying goodbye to Speller, who they had this kind of like connection, but they never like sort of consummated their they kind of dug each other or whatever. back in Olympia. But anyway, that's been our show.
They dug each other.
They dug each other. They had a kind of, you know, game recognizes game type of thing going on. You know, what could have been. Star-crossed lovers type of thing. So, cool.
So the next chapter is called Homesick.
Homesick. And we're going to start heading back to Earth.
Oh, boy.
And we're going to have all kinds of new problems. With that, obviously, because otherwise it wouldn't be a novel.
Yeah, if there weren't any problems.
Yeah, they need conflict. You got to have conflict in a novel. I'm learning this. Okay, you can email us at maroononmarspodcast@gmail.com and tweet us at podcastonmars. You can subscribe to the show, rate and review us on iTunes, tell all your friends about it. And
we should also say first, thanks to everybody for listening and people who've like emailed us and tweeted us and all that stuff. That's like amazing. And also I hope that everybody is as safe and well as it is possible to be right now.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. Thank you for emailing us and enjoying the show and listening. And please, yes, do be safe. Do your social distancing. I was at the grocery store. It was a rather depressing experience, kind of eerie and weird. Everybody was doing their social distancing, even up here in Maine. you know, call your local representative, your congressional representatives and complain about the things that you need to be complaining about. And
call up the other tenants in your building and organize a rent strike. Do it.
One of our listeners has bought the domain householdersunion.org, I believe, in an effort to kick off a, you know, New York 2140 style global rent strike or help or contribute to that kind of effort. I know that it's going to be happen. Something's happened. Something big is happening in Chicago. Things are happening in San Francisco and Los Angeles.
They're happening everywhere. I just read a kind of amazing piece, actually in Commune, so you can check it out, commune.com, I think.
Isn't it org?
It would make more sense, wouldn't it? Yeah. It's a Commune something, Commune magazine.
CommuneMag.com.
About groups in Italy doing sort of large-scale mutual aid organizing. Very inspiring and cool to read.
And you will not read about it, obviously, in the corporate media.
No. And I think that, you know, like, whatever. Everybody should just be doing what feels possible to them right now because this is a really hard time. But I also don't think anybody should be thinking that, like, this is not a moment that might not be extremely, just be rich with possibility for those of us who want a different world. And we should just got to hold on to that and think about it and do what you can and take care of people.
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to maybe learn how to do sourdough bread. That's about all I can muster up at this point, I think.
It's satisfying.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying.
Yeah. I like sourdough bread.
It's a living thing. Yeah. It's nice to have your little living thing.
Yeah. Okay. Great. We'll hopefully see you next week.
Yep.
And
thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.